Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our monthly episode of the Cinephiles Live. And today, we are celebrating the 10-year passing of Robin Williams. I am the outlaw John Rocha, one of the co-hosts here on the Cinephiles, joined as always by my spectacular co-host here, Steve Morris. Steve, how are you?
Apparently, I'm spectacular. That's pretty cool. I mean, it's not alliterative the way a Stan Lee introduced. I guess no, spectacular Steve Morris. It is. It is. You have given me my Stan Lee name. So I'm very excited about that. Hey. I'm also thrilled to talk about this person that is extremely important to me, particularly in my younger years. Robin Williams was a big person in my life.
Yeah. You know, I have to say I'm in the same boat with you, Steve. I think this gentleman was a formative person in many people's lives, especially for those of us who grew up from a certain generation or within years of each other. Robin Williams was such a massive, massive part of our lives, and of course passed away sadly. As we've spoken about mental health, we've spoken about how diseases can affect our minds on the show. We lost him 10 years ago to a suicide. And of course there's been conversations about how that all went down. But really, most people are focused on the tragedy of the loss and the appreciation of his incredible work and what he left us with in terms of a legacy, not only from TV to film, comedy to drama and everything in between, live action, animation, his philanthropy, his charity work, his stage work, his friendships, his willingness to appear and help at any number of organizations to lend his name, to lend his talent. And certainly we are the cinephiles. So movies are the number one things that we think about when we think about Robin Williams in our context of a show. But of course his influence stretches out into multiple mediums. So Steve, talk to us. I mean, as you just let off the show here, you spoke about how he's a really important person in your life since you were a kid. Explain your point of view on that.
So when I was growing up, the coolest person in the world, obviously, was the Fonz. And I did not miss an episode of Happy Days. Yeah. I wore a fake leather jacket as I rode my Huffy bike to school when I was 8 years old. I had the Happy Days album of rock and roll music. Oh, yeah. And when I wore my fake leather jacket and rode my Huffy bike, I was wearing a T-shirt with the Fonz going, "Hey,
that's right."
That was the coolest thing in the world until Robin Williams showed up on Happy Days And I first saw Mork, and then Mork was the coolest thing in the world. And to say that I was obsessed with Robin Williams is the biggest understatement in the world. Like, frankly, one of the many reasons I do not speak Hebrew today is because of Robin Williams.
Oh, wow.
And that is because as I was practicing for my bar mitzvah, you kind of had in my very reformed temple in San Francisco, the synagogue was sort of like, well, you could actually learn to speak Hebrew, or you could learn to say your Torah portion in Hebrew and read enough of it to get through your bar mitzvah. And the thing was, the Hebrew class was on the same night as Mork and Mindy.
Oh, wow.
I swear to God, it was like, well, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to miss that much Mork and Mindy. There's no way that's going to happen. And so needless to say, I do not speak Hebrew today, but I do know Robin Williams really, really well. And I have to say one other thing, which is that he is the most famous person ever to come out of my high school, Redwood High School in California, and that he grew up when he was 16. He moved to Belvedere, which is maybe, this is 1967. It's maybe 2 miles from my house, where I grew up, where my parents moved in 1968. So while I never met the man, my drama teacher, my freshman year at high school, was his drama teacher when he graduated in like 69.
Wow.
From my same high school. Yeah. So my I had Robin Williams' drama teacher my freshman year at Redwood. Wow, so real incredible. Huge connections to this guy.
Yeah. Like Steve, I got to know Robin Williams through more. I was a avid watcher of Happy Days as well. Even now on Pluto TV, I watch old Happy Days episodes. Ooh,
how's that hold up?
By the way, up-resed to HD. So watching them in HD at this age has given me a whole new appreciation of the performances and the work. And of course, Ron Howard, but Henry Winkler as well. But yeah, are some of the episodes a little rough sometimes?
Sure.
But I mean, overall, it's the nostalgia of it and seeing it so brightly colored and seeing it so... clear, I think, has been a great experience. And whenever those Mork episodes pop up, they're always a lot of fun. Like you, I became a massive Mork and Mindy fan because of the Mork character. I remember the first fight I ever had with my family was because I rushed home from riding bikes and playing football to home to see Mork and Mindy, and my dad was watching something else and started crying, yelling at him, saying Mork and Mindy is on, because back then, ladies and gentlemen, we didn't have DVRs. We didn't watch it on YouTube. It had to show that night. And if you missed it, you missed it. And all the kids were talking about it. And if you missed the episode, you couldn't talk about it and you'd have it spoiled for you.
Yep.
We had spoiler warnings as kids back then. So I understand absolutely. I feel the same way as you did. Like Mork and Mindy was such a massive part of my life. I didn't even know who the Denver Broncos were till I watched Mork, for God's sakes. And those episodes were so great. Of course, developing a young crush on Pam Dauber, but also like that scene of him running out in the cheerleading outfit. There were so many wonderful stories and memories and lessons from Mork and Mindy that I thought were fantastic, along with the comedy, along with all the madness of what he was able to create. And of course, from there, we go right into the movies, Popeye being his first starring role here for Robert Altman, doing a version of that beloved animated character. And then we see him go into a number of things like Good Morning Vietnam, where he really shows us he gives us a hint to his dramatic capabilities here. We move into Awakenings, Good Will Hunting, The Sweetness of Hook, Aladdin, and like stuff like One Hour Photo as he's getting later in life. But always remembering the joy and humor of Rob Williams here with Walter Cronkite in a juxtaposition of serious and humor, always capturing the right amount of humor at the right time in so many different scenarios. And what an incredible career, Steve. He won an Academy Award, obviously, for Good Will Hunting, 2 Primetime Emmy Awards, 6 Golden Globe Awards, 5 Grammy Awards, 2 SAG Awards, and was awarded the Cecil B. DeMille Award in 2005. Not too bad for a kid who was born in 1951 and found his way right at the right time through these different medium as they were blowing up in the world, man. It's an incredible legacy he left, and we can arguably say he died so early in his life with so much more he could have given over the next few decades if he had not been diagnosed or not contracted that disease and unfortunately taken his own life.
I think, and we sure we can say this about a lot of people, but there is nobody like Robin Williams. Mm-mm. I mean, and there are all sorts of, in the way that I wouldn't say it in the same way about Tom Cruise. And I would say there's probably nobody like Tom Cruise, but Robin Williams is his own thing. And I think the biggest thing is that there are a lot of comedians who found success as actors, and in particular as dramatic actors. And you go, oh, he's like one of them, except he's not.
Yeah.
Because he is an actor who found success as a comedian.
Right.
You know, I think that's one of the critical things, is that his goal was always to be an actor. He was playing serious parts in high school, in junior college, where he went to College of Marin. He in Juilliard, obviously, he was always like a serious actor who happened to be ridiculously funny. Yeah. It's that his comedy, and I will say this thing too about him, is that he is one of those people who I think gets the title for a certain amount of time as the funniest human in the world. You know, and nobody holds this title forever. You know, like I think right after him, Eddie Murphy is the funniest human in the world.
Right.
You know what I mean? But like, that's a rare title, and to be able to hold that title and be that funny at that time. And of course, anyway, not that he wasn't funny later, and then have these just incredibly beloved performances, particularly in things obviously like Good Will Hunting, Good Morning Vietnam, and things like that. But it's like, there's nobody else like that.
Yeah. And it's just an interesting point, guys. I didn't know this until doing research for the show. I didn't know he was born in Chicago. I didn't know he was a Chicago boy. Like, he was born in St. Luke's Hospital in 1951. His dad was a senior executive at Ford in the Lincoln Mercury division. His mother, Lori, was a former model from Jackson, Mississippi, whose great-grandfather was Mississippi Senator and Governor Anselm J. McLaurin. I had no idea he had connections in that way. And he was his mother was a practitioner of Christian Science. His dad was Episcopalian. So he says that that's where he got his faith, Episcopalian. But he said his mom is the biggest influence on him, in that it was his desire. He said this on the Actor's Studio. His desire to entertain his mom, to make his mom laugh, is what kind of triggered his desire to do comedy, his desire to be and do comedy, as you said here, or as we've said here. He attended elementary school at Lake Forest, then went to middle school to Deer Path, and then, of course, and then moved into a farmhouse, a 40-room farmhouse on 20 acres there, when his dad transferred to Detroit, right, in suburban Bloomfield Hills. And as you said, it was when Williams was 16 that his father took early retirement and the family moved to Tiburon, California, and attended Redwood High School nearby Larkspur. So
It's funny. It's funny hearing my dear Latino friend correctly pronounce my small town that nobody ever calls that. I grew up in Tiburon. I did not, unfortunately, grow up in Tiburon,
which is shark in Spanish.
Shark. But why do you think that one of my prized possessions is a Jaws poster in my house, which says Tiburon?
But here's the deal with him. He was special from the beginning. That's the thing that people like. He wasn't a kid. Yes, he was kind of a quiet kid at times, but certainly was a comedian, was a funny guy, but has charm, had connections, was able to like make connections with human beings. He was voted most likely not to succeed and yet the funniest by his classmates. And then he enrolled in Claremont Men's College at Claremont, California, to study political science. And he dropped out to pursue acting. So this is a man of intelligence who looked at political science as a possibility for his future, but then dropped out to pursue acting. He studied for 3 years at the College of Marin, as Steve was saying, which is in Kentfield, California. And this is where you discover what he can do drama-wise, doing Oliver as Fagin. This is what his professor, James Dunn, who you're talking about here, realized the depth of his abilities. He went to Juilliard in 1973 with a full scholarship here. His classmates were Christopher Reeve, William Hurt, Mandy Patinkin. Only Robin Williams and Christopher Reeve were the only two people accepted from that class to the John Houseman Advanced Program at school that year. He left Juilliard after 3 years because John Houseman told him there was nothing more that Juilliard could teach him as an actor. I mean, when John Houseman says to you, you don't even need to finish here, you're already ready to go, that's a hell of a blessing or an assessment of your talent at such a young age. So incredible stuff here, Steve, and certainly a lot of people having positive comments about him at Juilliard who worked with him.
Being that Houseman is the guy, arguably among the people that discovered Orson Welles, like saying there's nothing more to teach you. That is a hell of a statement. And I'm just thinking of, there are many, many, many nights with some beer or some weed that Mandy Patinkin, William Hurt, Christopher Reeve, and Robin Williams are hanging out together. And I just like, can you imagine Robin Williams and Mandy Patinkin improvising on songs and we and Christopher? I mean, like, it must have been, talk about some geniuses all in one place together. I can't imagine it.
Arguably, some of the most cerebral people ever in approaching acting. So no surprise, and we should throw Franklin Seals in there, who was Robin Williams' roommate. For those who don't know, he was the black lawyer for four seasons on Silver Spoons. After Leonard Lightfoot left, Franklin Seals came in. Sadly, Franklin, who was an artist and a painter, passed away at a young age in his early 30s or mid-30s from AIDS. But he was Robin Williams' classmate. So another cerebral person, another artistic person there. All of them getting together probably to have some incredible conversations about life and about the world, especially at a time when, like, the world was blowing up with Vietnam and the protests in the street. It must have been fascinating to be sitting there at Juilliard having these conversations with them. After this, and this is a good lesson for you all, just because John Houseman blesses your ass, it doesn't mean you're going to walk right into work. He was working as a busboy for 3 years after he left Juilliard in 74, 75, and 76 at the Trident in Sausalito, California. Pretty incredible stuff there. And then eventually found his way into doing stand-up in the late 70s here and found his way step-by-step through this process to get seen by people there at the Comedy Store. George Schlatter is the one who sees him and brings him on to a revival of Laugh-In, which doesn't really work out. Then he does another show there in HBO at the LA Improv, for HBO at the LA Improv. And that's where they spot him. They spot him to do Mork and Mindy. That's how they, or to do Mork rather, on Happy Days. That's where he comes on. And it's from there, with Gary Marshall spotting him, that he becomes Mork. And it was going to be a one show, one episode appearance.
Sure. But
the audience loved him so much, Steve, that they created an entire show for him off of his appearance there on Happy Days. Incredible.
There's so much about his career and coming up. By the way, it's just cracking me up hearing you name a whole bunch of cities, which is literally just where I grew up. You know, Sausalito and Kent Field. And like, this is where I was riding my bike to. It's just fun. But from what I understand, when he showed up at the Holy City Zoo in San Francisco, which is the comedy club, and there's a mini comedy renaissance in the mid-70s, is that he didn't even have a mic. Like, I think he would just wander the crowd improvising. Yes. And then he comes down to the Comedy Store. And my understanding, and I've heard this because I listened to all of the Mark Maron podcast, and so all those comedians, and he's a Comedy Store guy, come on, for those guys from the 70s. And they said when Robin showed up, it was an explosion. Like, there was nothing. It wasn't like, there was also like Pryor would show up. But when Pryor showed up, you didn't know what you're going to get. And it might very well be genius. And it might just be really emotional. And it could be whatever it was. And that was an event, obviously. When Robin showed up, it just, nobody could follow him. He destroyed the house. He just wrecked everything. And the thing too, and this is one of those moments in history that doesn't succeed, but the one that you didn't mention is that the Richard Pryor show. Yes. Is that Pryor like gets his own TV show, and Robin Williams is on it. And you just think about, man, Robin Williams and Richard Pryor in a sketch comedy show, this must be the greatest thing that's ever happened in the history of the world. And of course, it ends up not being that, you know, for many, many reasons. Lack of talent obviously isn't one of them. And so, like, the momentum that this guy had going to Happy Days and then Mork and Mindy, it is a perfect explode. And the Mork and Mindy thing is just a star turn. This is where you go like, oh, this is a star.
Yeah.
Now we just have to find a vehicle where he can do his star thing, you know?
Yeah. And the crazy thing is that he replaced someone as Mork.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he was a last minute cast replacement for a departing actor to play Mork. They had emergency acting auditions for Mork because the actor who was going to play him was leaving, or didn't want to do it, or was leaving the part. So he was discovered in that way. And Gary Marshall said that it was when he sat on his head when he was asked to take a seat for an audition, that's where he kind of like turned around on Robin Williams in that way. And of course, from there, Steve, I mean, listen,
That show was such a success. People don't even know how big this. People don't remember how big this show was. He appeared on the cover of Time magazine in 1979. Do you know how many comedians have appeared off a sitcom on the cover of Time magazine? It's rarefied air. Time magazine and then the next week Rolling Stone. Pretty incredible to have that. And the Time magazine cover is now installed in the National Portrait Gallery at the Smithsonian. It was installed after shortly after Williams died, so people could go there and pay tribute to him, who quit, maybe couldn't go to the other places where he shot his movies or where he lived to pay tribute to him. So I thought that's an incredible, again, appreciation for what he brought to the world. And as he's having this success, Steve, also he's doing all of these comedy albums, Off the Wall, An Evening with Robin Williams, A Night at the Met. These are all, as we enter into the early 80s here, he won a Grammy Award for Best Comedy Album for his 1979 live show. And then we get into The World According to Garp in 1982, where he gets some love from Roger Ebert for his performances there. I didn't know this, I forgot that he co-hosted the Academy Awards in 1986. I had no idea that he had co-hosted the Academy Awards before Billy Crystal ever hosted them.
It's crazy.
It was Ron Williams co-hosting them. But it's when we get to Good Morning Vietnam that I think everything starts to change. Don't you, Steve? Like, that's the moment where, like, you start to glimpse that this guy can be so much more. The frenetic energy can slow down. He can play a more serious character who is discovering, who can still be funny, but also is discovering some of the sadness of Vietnam. And ironically, also, this is the time where he's lived through in the 1970s when he's at Juilliard.
I think Good Morning Vietnam, which I don't know, I haven't watched it in a while. My memory is that the last time I watched it, it hadn't aged as well as I had wanted it to.
Right.
But I think it is the perfect melding of, because it's essentially what's weird about Robin Williams, one of the many weird things, is that he is a comedian who doesn't have comedy movie hits.
Yes.
You know, he's right. Not like Will Ferrell. He's not like Eddie Murphy. He's not, who has these, you know, massive, you know, some of the earlier movies, they're not big hits and they're not that funny. Whereas Good Morning Vietnam, what it does is that it allows him to do what he's amazing at, better than any other human, which is just improvising on the mic.
Yeah.
And shows his comedy chops. Shows his drama chops. I mean, that's the real magic of that film. I do want to go back to a couple of things, actually, which is one, the comedy albums. So I didn't know until much later, and you know, everyone who's listened to the show knows I'm obsessively listen to audiobooks and obsessively listen to podcasts. Well, when I was a kid, I was obsessively listening to my parents' musical theater albums and listening to comedy albums. And I didn't know, like, oh, I like storytelling through my ears. That's actually, but I didn't know that at the time, but that's what it was. And so I was listening to Cosby over and over and over again. Cool. And then I discovered Carlin and Steve Martin. And so that's sort of the mid 70s. And Carlin obviously is brilliant, and Steve Martin also brilliant.
Yeah.
But as soon as Woe Reality, What a Concept came out, I was, it's like, goodbye, Bill Cosby. I'm not interested in you anymore. And like, because the thing about those comedy albums, unlike like Carlin, he has crafted every single word.
Mm-hmm.
Cosby knows every pause. Steve Martin's whole thing is really surreal and bizarre, but he has worked it out. Robin Williams doesn't actually always know what he's going to say next. In fact, the best stuff is that he doesn't know what he's going to say next. And there's an element of Robin Williams that is not in control when he's doing comedy. It's like stuff is going to happen, which is why he has a reputation for stealing jokes, which he has acknowledged, and why he's paid off people. Like, not paid off in a bad way. Like, people come to him and say, hey, you stole my joke. And he would go, you're probably right, I'm really sorry. Because he's not in control. It's not that he's purposely seeing a thing and going, oh, I can use that in my act. It's that his mouth is responding to whatever's happening, and you don't know where it's going to go. And watching him, and maybe you'll get to this later, but with the Billy and Whoopi talk, you know, like, you could see them watching him going, which way is he going to jump? Because they had to be completely in the moment in order to deal with what he's going to do. Those, and that's what you see. The only movie that's captured in is Good Morning Vietnam. And Good Morning Vietnam, because he had the freedom to do it. Whereas if you look at his earlier movies, so I decided I was going to watch a few Robin Williams movies, and I picked some very strange ones, which is I picked one that I had never seen that I had always heard about.
Okay.
Which is Death to Smoochie.
Yes.
Which I had never, and it was fascinating. I totally loved it, by the way.
Weird little film.
Then I went back and watched the first Robin Williams movie that I knew about, which I had in shoot. This is why I say Robin Williams means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. In junior high, I was always acting. Okay. And so I started acting in second grade and always was in whatever the after school acting program there was. I was in it. So I had, I know it's ridiculous, in seventh or eighth grade, a after school sketch comedy group. And we did our little sketch comedy shows and we charged admission for the shows. And with the money we made from our sketch comedy group, we went to see Popeye.
Oh,
and okay. I was a huge Popeye fan as a kid watching the cartoons. So Popeye is another movie I rewatched. That movie doesn't work.
Nope.
It doesn't work at all. And it doesn't work in spite of all. It's the one I would compare it to, strangely enough, is Spielberg's 1941, which is like there's all this talent here. And that all this talent is doing a whole bunch of stuff. And theoretically, some of this stuff should work and none of it works.
Yeah,
it doesn't work at all. And Robin Williams is great, except it doesn't work. So,
yeah, I mean, his movies, you know, are in my life at my formative years of 12 and 13. Like World According to Garp is the first R-rated.
That is the other movie I watched.
By
the
way. Yeah. World According to Garp is the first R-rated film my parents accidentally took me to. It's the first R-rated film I ever watched because they thought it was Mork and Mindy. They thought it was Rob Williams being Mork. And we went in there, and I can't tell you how many times my eyes were covered, my ears were covered with my parents, my Latino immigrant parents, who are shocked at all the stuff that's in Garp. Because, of course, you've got oral sex scene. You've got a person transitioning from male to female. There's so much that goes on in that movie that is so unsettling. Not the greatest of movies, but Robin Williams, I think, delivers.
He's really good.
Yeah, a pathos-laced performance. And the ending is so sweet and so touching. I remember the scene where he bites the dog's ear after the dog has bit him. And so there was so much about, and that was my first exposure to an R-rated film. So in that way, Robin Williams, I'm tied to him in that way. Survivors, I was becoming a Walter Matthau fan from watching those films. So watching that film with him, not a great film, but certainly memorable scenes that I enjoyed. But Moscow on the Hudson, which I recently watched again on a Pluto TV, I watched it. I hadn't watched it in years. And I had used to religiously watch that film because it's about a Russian immigrant into our country. And having immigrant parents, there was so much about that movie as a 14-year-old or 13-year-old when I watched it the first time that spoke to me from seeing my parents' experience as immigrants. What was captured in that film is so heartbreaking and touching and moving. Is it an overly long film? Yes. Does the stuff with Maria Conchita Alonso work? It's kind of weird and wonky, but the pathos that Robin Williams captures in this character, who is the first to defect after his friend says he's going to defect, his friend chickens out. Rob Williams' character doesn't. And so he's all alone in America having to figure this out without his best friend as a Russian. And seeing what he goes through, seeing what he experiences, seeing all the things like an immigration lawyer and he's got to hit these quotas. He's got to do these jobs, all these things he's experiencing while he's missing his family. It's incredible. And he's a saxophonist. And then when he has visions, when he sees his family showing up because he's super sad, it is a depressing movie about immigration. Yet within it, there's a real understanding and appreciation of the experience. So that film has always touched me and moved me. And that was the thing that kind of solidified for me who Robin Williams was and had the possibility to be when I was a 14, 13-year-old kid when I watched that movie. That movie still holds up today. Some of those scenes are still as heartbreaking and devastating and touching to watch as they were back then. So that's those things. This early 80s is him, I think, just kind of working it out. And then 87, and we go on the ride with him, really, into these movies where he hits the stratosphere, Steve, overall.
This is what I mean. There's no one like Robin Williams. Because, I think, first of all, Popeye, Garp, Moscow on the Hudson, all flawed movies. Mm-hmm. Robin Williams is not the flaw.
No.
Robin Williams, and you think about, okay, we have the currently funniest human on the planet. Let's put him in Popeye, where he can't do any of his comedy the way that he does it, because he's locked into a character. Part of what Robin Williams' greatness is the ability to bounce from character to character, to voice to voice instantly. Yeah. Yeah. So now we lock him into this character who doesn't even speak very well, and you go, okay, did he do a great job as Popeye? He totally did. Is it a good movie? No. Then he's in Garp, where he is completely restrained throughout the whole movie. And I actually really like Garp, and I think his performance is really good, but it is not, you've taken a person who 60 million people are watching a week, and then you put them in, you go like, you know what we're going to do with this person? We're going to put them in an R-rated movie that deals with rape and sex and violence and all, you know, all sorts of total bizarreness.
Right.
That's what we're going to do with this person. And then Moscow on the Hudson, it's not that it's not funny. I like that movie a lot.
Yeah.
It is funny. But the key to Moscow on the Hudson is the pathos, is the pain, is is the loneliness of this figure, and that you really, really feel for him. And so it's like the contrast. And that's why I say Good Morning Vietnam is the only movie that melds these two things, that allows him to be really, really funny, which is his skill as a comedian, and be, you know, have the drama, which is really his skill as an actor. And you know, the other thing I think, too, is that his comedy is uniquely not suited to movies. He's not a I'm gonna play in this funny scene with this person. He is I am funny. That's why it works in Good Morning Vietnam. I'm doing funny stuff. I will make up funny things. That's not what's happening in most comedic movies, you know, that they work in a, they operate in a different system.
I think you're 100% correct, and that's the thing. But this is also the two sides of Robin Williams. That's the thing, like the comedy side is being worked out when he's doing a stand-up, when he's doing these other things, right? But clearly he is a dramatic actor. He has the instincts of a dramatic actor, which is what draws him to these films early on in his career. Garp, Survivors, which is really about two people convinced that the end of the world is coming and how do they navigate that, which is a very funny approach to that. And they deal with this crazy cult. But and then you get into, as we said, Moscow on the Hudson, which is an exploration of immigration. So his instincts are there to find the comedies within the seriousness, but the seriousness is always over on top of everything of what he's doing when he chooses this stuff. But yes, Good Morning Vietnam is where the mix starts to happen. And from there, we jump to Dead Poets Society. We jump to Awakenings. We jump to The Fisher King, and we jump to Hook, and then eventually Aladdin. That's from 87 to 92. I just gave you all. This is where Robin Williams launches into the stratosphere, and you can bring along Mrs. Doubtfire as well. But really, it's Aladdin where you really understand the global impact of Robin Williams. But these films that lead up to it, I think, are important, with Fisher King and Awakenings and Hook, that lead him into Aladdin. That's what really solidifies him as a multi-generational talent as an actor.
I mean, Dead Poets Society is another film that manages to meld those two things. He's not as crazy comedic as he is in Good Morning Vietnam, but he still gets to give these speeches and make these jokes and put on voices as he's a teacher in these classes. And I have to tell you yet another weird Robin Williams connection, which is that I'm at Cal and we're casting plays, and there's this guy who's did this amazing audition for this play, but he couldn't end up acting in it because he had to go to Europe for the Venice Film Festival or something. And so it ended up that someone else got cast and I got cast in a play because this guy had to drop out. And then no one would cast this actor at Cal because they didn't think he was reliable. So I cast him in my first play that I've talked about over and over again, Brothers. He was one of the actors. He stole the show. His name is Dylan Kussman, and he is the redheaded guy, Cameron, who turns everybody in Dead Poets Society.
Right.
So Dylan acted for me in several plays and in the very first movie I ever made, the very first short, when I was in like a film class up in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Fantastic actor. And so I got to ask him, what is Robin Williams like? Because he had, you know, was a kid. He's one of these kids. Right. And he basically said what I have since heard over and over and over again, which is he's very quiet. He is not the character, the wild and crazy character that you see in the movies. He is very sensitive, super gentle, incredibly supportive, incredibly kind, and would just, you know, and for all these young actors that came along, really was a steady mentor for all of them.
Wow.
Like, just seems like a great person. And so I got to direct this actor who had acted with Robin Williams, which for me, which also led, because he was in the first movie that Bryan Singer and Chris McQuarrie did that went to Sundance, called Public Access. And so that's how I met Chris McQuarrie, which is how I almost got beat up with Chris McQuarrie in a Denny's in Emeryville. So before all of them made it big. So that's the strange Robin Williams connection that I have there.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I can't match any of that. So I'm going to let that just be there, which is great.
But like, yeah, for me, this is again, this is when you're coming into your, I'm coming into my 20s. Here is Robin Williams, right? And for me, I'm coming into also learning to appreciate film. This is how we circle back to the cinephiles, right? Dead Poets Society, that I put what happens to Robert Sean Leonard's character in the same boat as what happens to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, to what happens to Billy or Bobby. What was the kid who kills himself
It's Billy.
Billy, yeah. To what happens to Billy. Like, both of those scenes wrecked me so hard that I rarely ever watch those movies. But that after scene where he walks in and he grabs his stuff and those guys stand on the desk, Ethan Hawke and the crew, there was so, I remember crying in the theater as a 19-year-old watching that movie, just seeing that heartbreak and that pain. Because, you know, I'm at that time where I'm like understanding how teachers can influence your life and impact you and believe in you and influence you. And so seeing that come at a time as I'm just out of high school, going into college for the first time and about to go in the military a year or two later, like, that is so powerful, that Dead Poets Society movie. And then we get Awakenings, which to me, I think, is his dry run at Good Will Hunting. It's his dry run, which this dramatic performance within this, Robert De Niro delivering one of his most amazing performances as well that people don't talk about enough. Both of them as a 1-2 with the great Julie Kavner there as a slight comic relief every once in a while. It's a devastating movie, and yet people don't talk about Awakenings or see it in the same amount that they see stuff like Good Will Hunting or other stuff from his career. And I think it's such a shame, because to me, that's one of his most incredible performances. And as if that isn't enough, Fisher King comes along, and then we go, what the fuck? This guy is a master actor. This is not a comedian who can do crazy shit and you could just you put him in that category. He's a man with genuine talent to bring these characters with super incredible levels of pathos to life in ways that are so endearing and heartbreaking at the same time. And so it's just, it was incredible to watch him come into his prime during this time and see, and be able to see his work on the big screen and on TV, you know? So just fascinating to watch this time with him as a performer.
If you imagine someone who was a world champion in the 60s, a movie star in the 80s, a TV star in the 90s, and a cultural icon by the early 2000s, you would probably expect that by 2024, they would be quietly enjoying their golden years and knowing that their healthiest days were long behind them. But guess what? At 84 years old, Chuck Norris is still kicking. In fact, he says he has more energy and is getting in better workouts than he has in years. And all of that is due to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale, probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. You just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. And unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. The truth is, I'm drinking it right now. And while I've never been a fan of energy smoothies or protein powders, mostly because I don't think they taste good, I genuinely like the flavor of this one, and I do think I felt better and had more energy since trying it out. I also know that maintaining gut health and good digestion is one of the most important factors in healthy living, particularly as you get to be my age. So go to roundhouseprovisions.com/cinephiles for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/CINEFILES today. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results may vary.
You know, John, the summer has been really, really hot. And yeah, my solution to it is to keep Fiji water on hand to keep my family and me hydrated and refreshed. It really is from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable, ancient artisan aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements.
Yeah, Stephen, doing research for Fiji water because I've really enjoyed the product and I like to find out more about the product. One of the things I discovered is as the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other top two premium bottled water brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters,
Fiji Water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring.
And this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji Water really is Earth's finest water. And since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic. So you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji Water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office, which is where I have it right now. It's not just water, it's Fiji Water. You know what I'm just discovering as we're having this conversation?
Yeah.
Is that, so we said, like, he explodes on the scene, right? And,
yeah.
And they go, this guy's a star. We got to put him in a star vehicle. He does Mark and Mindy. This is huge. He's Time Magazine. He's all this stuff happens. But strangely enough, it took another decade almost for people to really figure out how to use him.
Is that
as a just comedic force of nature, he totally works. But in a movie, it was a little bit harder to figure out. And I think you see, like Popeye has a piece of it, but not the whole thing. Garp has a piece of it, but not the whole thing. Moscow the Hudson maybe has more of it. Then you get into Good Morning Vietnam. It's like, oh, we're starting to figure it out. And then where we are now, Dead Poets and Awakenings and Fisher King, it's like, got it. Like this guy has incredible talent to play characters, real depth to play emotion, and can have these really, really funny things if you have a director who knows how to use it. And that's the other thing is like, because he's not in control. And so if you just give him full rein and he'll go off, he's not going to serve the needs of the story, or he's super controlled. Like you see, like Good Will Hunting, he is locked really in exactly where he needs to be. But so it's like getting him to fit into what you need for the movie, it seems like a challenging thing. And I think maybe, I don't know, it's trying to think about both Dead Poets Society and Awakenings are just incredible performances top to bottom where you 100% believe those characters. But then I went, well, so is Fisher King and so is a bunch of others.
But then we slide into his kind of family phase, which all leads us to a new golden age, because you get Mrs. Doubtfire, you get which I think is I think you get an episode of television from him, Homicide: Life on the Street, with which, if you guys have never seen that episode, with Robin Williams as someone whose family's been killed while he's visiting Baltimore and he's hunting for vengeance for the people who killed his family, it is an incredible dramatic performance from Robin Williams. But Mrs. Doubtfire is here. We have Fern Gully as well. 9 months is a part of this. Jumanji is where he comes. Birdcage comes in to be a part of this. And then he does an appearance on Friends. And then we get to Good Will Hunting. So to me, I think Good Will Hunting is the last gasp of the consistently great Robin Williams content, because after that, it becomes a law of diminishing returns. But I think from Mrs. Doubtfire all the way up until Good Will Hunting, that's another second half of the 90s where you see him enter into a whole new phase as a performer, the dad childhood type of phase. And he nails it all the way up until we get to Good Will Hunting.
I think you make a really great point of this transition into sort of the more family films. And I think it obviously starts with Aladdin. You know,
right. You could start with Aladdin. A great point.
Because I think about, like, Aladdin, I wouldn't put it into my weird category of great movies that ruin Hollywood. But to some degree, I go, like, there's a lesson that I think that Disney takes from Aladdin. Previous to Aladdin, there are no stars, you know, in the animated films.
Yeah.
They're voices. They're voice actors. And then post Aladdin, it seems like more and more it's like, well, let's cast a star to play this part because we get so much out of it. And that But the thing about that Aladdin performance is that, again, it's harnessing what he is good at, which is they just give him a lot of tape and let him go. And I am certain that there are five times as many outtakes, you know, as there are the stuff that was used in the film.
Yeah.
But that and it still has that bit of pathos that you want. Moving forward into things like it's so funny because, and I think this is where my age changes, like, I don't think I ever saw Mrs. Doubtfire in the theater. I don't think I saw it until years later. Like what year did it come out? It's like
91.
It took me a long time before I saw Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, sorry, 93. Sorry about
that. Makes more sense, because that is right before I'm moving to LA to go to film school.
Yeah.
And I am probably, you know, mid-20s and grumpy, like, I'm not gonna see that, you know, the kind of thing. But you're right, there is a tremendous run of movies that go on here. I think it, oh, and the other one that we have to talk about, and maybe you were going to bring, maybe you mentioned it and I didn't hear it, but one that we did on one of my favorite episodes of The Cinephiles, which is The Birdcage, of course.
Yes, yes, I did mention it, but we can definitely go into it. I want to give Jonathan Peck credit. He's completely right. Hook is the beginning of the family.
Oh, sure.
91 Hook, then Aladdin 92, and then we go into Mrs. Doubtfire 93. As we said here, Jumanji in 95, Birdcage in 96, and then, of course, wrapping up with Good Will Hunting in 97. So, yes, I mean, Birdcage, we talked about it, you and I, and Michael Vogel was our special guest. That's a film that still endures, still resonates. It's a fantastic film. But again, here is him portraying a gay man and taking the chance to portray a gay man as a lead in this gay comedy and love story with another gay actor in Nathan Lane, in a way saying, like, all this judgment, all this hatred, all this kind of negativity that people have addressed to the LGBTQ community, here, I'm going to lend my name. I'm going to lend my talent. I'm going to be a part of this under the direction of Mike Nichols and bring to life an incredibly funny film that endures and reaches people, even people who might have an issue with the LGBTQ community. They laugh at a film like this. They enjoy the film and enjoy the jokes within it and the story that's being told here. So just really smart in how he's picking the movies over these next few years. Didn't mean he doesn't have any missteps like Toys and a couple other films, but like overall, his instincts here are really honed to pick the right movies that showcase what he can do at this stage in his life. You know,
you know what just occurred to me is that I was saying before that he doesn't really fit into a pure comedy as a comedic actor. Birdcage is the exception that proves the rule, although yeah. I don't believe in that statement, but it is the movie that, like, it is, he's 100% part of a comedy ensemble where everybody is being really funny, including Gene Hackman, who is hilarious.
Oh yeah.
You know, that everybody in that movie is supporting each other to be really, really, really funny. It yeah. is such a good movie. And like I said, one of my favorite conversations on The Cinephiles. It's funny. So I had forgotten about Hook. And someone yeah. on the chat, who is an old friend of mine, Kimberly Rogers, wrote, talk about Dream Graveyard, Steve. And I was going to move past it because no one needed to hear that story, except this story actually relates to Hook.
Okay.
So thank you for bringing this up. I hated Hook when yeah. I saw it in the theater, hated it. And part of the reason that I hated it was right when it came out, I was doing another play starring Dylan Kussman, this actor that I already told you about that's in mm-hmm. Dead Poets Society, where I had basically found this ridiculous space where all of the old sets from the Cal Theater Department were stored in this huge space, like as big as two basketball courts, was just yeah. piles and piles of props and costumes and sets and stuff like that. And I'm like, this is the coolest place in the world. I want to make a play here. So yeah. I wrote a play, developed it out of improv, and yeah. the play had a character who basically turns into Peter Pan. And so wow. I did my deconstruction of Peter Pan, and it had a huge sword fight and a guy swinging down on a rope, all this crazy stuff. And my deconstruction of Peter Pan came out right when Hook came out, and I went to see Hook, and I was a huge Steven Spielberg fan
yeah.
and a huge Robin Williams fan, and I was so disappointed and so just bugged by it. That might be why I didn't see Mrs. Doubtfire a couple of years later.
Oh, wow.
You know, because I was just really grumpy about Hook, a movie I have not seen since it came out. My guess is I still wouldn't like it. That's my guess.
Oh, yeah. I'm not a fan of Hook. I think he is wonderful in the film. I think Dante Bosco, a personal friend of mine, is fantastic in the film as Rufio. But I think, but I'm not a big Julia Roberts fan as Tinkerbell. So it overall doesn't work for me. It kind of falls apart a little bit. Also, Hoffman as Captain Hook is okay. But not weird. Great. And so, it's kind of a weird film. But I know there are people like Michael Vogel who are a few years, who were born a few years after we were born.
Exactly.
This is their sweet spot. Hook is their sweet spot. People love it. So no judgment if you love that movie. Just, I think Steve and I are on the same page. It's not one of our favorites
right.
overall, which is why we probably will never do it on The Cinephiles.
Yeah.
You know, unless people don't.
But, you know, we have Jean Pepin in the chat. It's one yeah. of his favorites. And we will never, ever, you know, yuck anyone's yum. You no. love the movie. That's fantastic. That's great.
Absolutely. But of course, at 43, that tells you the difference in age that we were.
There. Yeah.
Just not our jam for sure. But then we get into a little bit of the, well, I know Jumanji, I know, is another one that people love, an enduring character. And of course, The Rock and Kevin Hart and a number of other people brought Jumanji back, Jack Black and Karen Gillan bringing back Jumanji again, which I think has been a lot of fun to see those two films back to back. But within these films that he's doing, he's also doing stuff like Hamlet, right? He's appearing in Hamlet. Yeah. He's appearing in Friends. He's in a Woody Allen film, Deconstructing Harry, now as we go into the second phase or third phase of his career, which has less hits and more misses, unfortunately. Like What Dreams May Come, not the best. Patch Adams, not so good. Jacob the Liar suffers from being compared to Life is Beautiful at the same time. Bicentennial Man is okay. I like 1 Hour Photo. I like Insomnia. I have not seen Death to Smoochie, so I think you can speak to that better than I can. I think The Final Cut is an interesting film for him that is exploring. He's starting to explore the darker edges of drama within this stage of his career. He's getting a little older, maybe a little more jaded by what he's seen in the world now as he's becoming older. 1 Hour Photo, he's playing a serial killer. And Death to Smoochie, isn't he like one of these people putting on one of these mascots, but he's like exposing what's going on. And then Insomnia, he's also a murderer in Insomnia. Final Cut, he's an editor who edits in the future. It's set in the future, who edits people's lives for their funerals into essentially a YouTube video that they play above their funerals. But he stumbles upon some information about a person that he's supposed to, and then becomes a guy on the run because of that. But then you get Robots, which I think is really fun. But then you get something like RV and Man of the Year. But then you get Happy Feet, and then you get Night at the Museum. So it just becomes like hit or miss, but more misses than hits. But when the hits hit, it's fun to rediscover him again with the right directors, you said earlier, and the right content to showcase what he can do as an actor, both dramatically and on the comedy side.
I mean, I think with lots of careers, there is a law of diminishing returns, you mm-hmm. know? Like you're just not fitting the zeitgeist. When I did my dumb DVD quality control job, we got Patch Adams in, and had to watch that over and over and over. And talk about a movie that does not do well for me on repeated view. And here you have these two geniuses, you know, in this film.
Yeah.
And like, and they're not, it's not that they're bad. It is just, it is so treacly sweet. It's not a movie that I like. And then there are other films. Like, it's what's interesting is like, is he good in Hamlet, which I know is a movie that was special to you?
I think he's good in Hamlet. Jack Lemmon is not good in Hamlet, but he plays Osric, and he plays Osric in a very flamboyant way. So it fits within the construct of the comedy that Shakespeare peppered into Hamlet. So
right.
I think he's good in Hamlet as Osric. And clearly understands it with his Juilliard training about how to play within the lines. So, yeah, I think he's good in it.
Yeah, and in movies like What Dreams May Come is like, well, this is an interesting experiment that doesn't work.
Yeah, you know? Right.
And I feel that way a little bit about some of the other ones where it's like, you know, Deconstructing Harry is sure, of course I'll work on a Woody Allen movie because at that time anyone would take that gig, you know. Right. Is he good in it? Yeah, he's fine in it, but it's not a really interesting performance. Death to Smoochie. So I have been hearing about this movie forever. You know, it is a legendary, crazy movie. I knew that Jon Stewart was in it. I knew that Ed Norton was in it. I knew that it was something about like cuddly children's mascots, you know, in costumes like, you know, Teletubbies or something like that. It is a sick, crazy movie. And for the first like 10 or 15 minutes, I was like, I don't know that I'm into this. I'm not sure. But it kind of won me over. And strangely enough, it's actually Ed Norton that won me over because Ed Norton also has a ridiculous run of incredible performances. Oh, yeah. And the fact that he goes to play this particular character who is 100% earnest about being a good person in children's television, you know, it just is. And it was so the opposite of all the weird, twisted sort of characters he's played that I was like, okay, it is completely bizarre. I absolutely think it deserves its place as a cult film and should be watched, you know, every once in a while, possibly when you're high, because that's when that film would work the best.
Well, I'm starting to do on my channel more
getting high and doing.
Yes, absolutely. Why not? No, first time watching movie. I've seen other channels do it. So like I'm creating a list. So I think Death to Smoochie might be one I would do on a week when I run out of other things that I really want to do at the top of my list and want to try something new and different and react to it. So I will keep that on my list based on your recommendations for sure, Steve.
It's something.
But yeah, I mean, as we go forward, you get stuff like I think Night at the Museum is another great gasp of the greatness of Robin Williams' comedy as Teddy Roosevelt mixed in with his genuine sweetness. I think it's Sacagawea that he has the crush on or the affection for and doesn't know how to ask her out. And so to have that mixed in with the wildness of Theodore Roosevelt, I think is a great showcase to remind us yet again, this far into his career, about how great he is as a performer and what he can do when he's got in the right circumstances. So I always loved him. And one of the reasons I enjoy those Night at the Museum movies is because of him and what he does with Teddy Roosevelt, my second favorite president, I guess, behind Lincoln. So it's just like, I love that he's an aspect of it all. But you've got the animation with Happy Feet. People loved Happy Feet and what have you. Then you get a little bit like The Butler. He plays Dwight D. Eisenhower in The Butler, which is really weird. And then we get to right at the end here. Four other films came out after he passed with Angriest Man in Brooklyn, Merry Friggin' Christmas, A Night at the Museum again, and does the voice of Dennis the Dog in Absolutely Anything. But around this time, peppered in, he's got appearances on TV. He does an episode of Louie, which if you haven't seen that episode, it's a pretty awesome episode with him and Louis C.K., regardless of how you feel about him and what he did. Wilford, I thought his episode on Wilford was hilarious as well. And so he pops in, he does a Law & Order SVU, which is an interesting choice to do as well. So just has these occasional TV drop-ins that I think work really well. So, you know, it's an incredible career full of some wonderful movies, Steve, that endure for us both live action and animation. And it's just I don't know, man, it's heartbreaking. I remember I'm still like him and Phil Hartman, I think are the top two ones for me of people who've died or comedians or comedians as well as other things. That just still to this day have such a massive air of tragedy because there was still so much more these two gentlemen could have given to us in our world, which could use that kind of humor, could use that kind of joy to remind us to laugh again. You know,
those are the two for me. There's no question about it. And when you said to me last week, it's the 10th anniversary of Robin Williams passing, I was shocked. I mean, it just like, I can't believe it's been that long.
I know.
And I think I do. I'm not 100% sure of what I'm about to say, but okay. I think it was Robin Williams that first started to clue me into this idea that the funny people aren't necessarily the happy people. You know, like, I think I started to learn that learning about him. And when I heard about struggles with addiction and I heard, you know, I started to go like, And in talking to my friend Dylan as well, of like going, oh, this isn't, it's not a one-to-one.
Yeah.
Like these are, it's not success makes you happy. It's not being funny means you happy. In fact, and this is, you know, something I've learned over the years, and it mostly came from Robert Heinlein's book, A Stranger in a Strange Land, has a moment about this of like, we all go, oh, laughter is this thing we do when we're happy. And it's like, usually not. Like laughter is this thing we do to deal with pain.
Yeah.
You know, like if you think of just slapstick and embarrassment comedy, none of that's about being happy. That's all about pain. Like all situational comedies where someone is misunderstandings and things like that, that's all about embarrassment and pain. Like we're using laughter as a way to deal with the pain of the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and the thing too that Robin Williams, and it goes to something we were talking about. I think we were talking about it when in our conversation about Ordinary People of this idea of the cerebral curse, which is, the more you think about stuff, sometimes that just makes you sadder, you know? And comedy is about going into those areas. And he would step into all these areas of sex and drugs and pain and depression and all these things and find ways to transform them into something that's funny, you know? And I think that's the magic of him. It's that mix of comedy and drama. He is literally the perfect example of the comedy and drama masks in theater. Like Robin Williams, you put those like Janus on either side and you see both of them working together. That's Robin Williams's greatness. You know what I mean?
I think you're 100% right. And I think I'm in the same boat with you without even having thought about it before. But yeah, like, you know, because we've spoken about mental health and certainly stuff I've endured. Sure. But you're right. I think I remember, because this is before I started knowing what this was, 2014, because my stuff didn't come on until 2016, but 2014, when you hear what they're saying about Robin and like, just because I think someone had a quote in reaction to his passing and said like, this is a guy who could walk down any street, and if he needed a hug or someone to give him money or someone to cheer him up or anyone to drink with him, a hundred people would run to be able to do that. Yet he felt that he was so lost in his pain and sadness that he had to take his life. And of course, we find out later about the Lewy body dementia and all of that, and how I'm looking for something that begins with in, but it goes, how it messes with your mind, how insidious it is and messes with your mind and gives you ideas and makes you think certain things are happening that are not happening. And even his wife said near the end, his third wife said, he just wanted to reboot his brain because he didn't understand why he was having these thoughts. He couldn't control these thoughts that were happening to him. And you know what's fascinating is I was reading, doing research for the show today, reading her quote made me think of something that I just experienced yesterday, which is I was watching Ken Burns's documentary on Ernest Hemingway. And by the way, right. Phenomenal documentary. It's really good. It's like, three or four parts? It's really incredible. Yeah, Steve. And the way they spoke, what he experienced at the end with his mind turning on him and his mind causing the paranoia and his mind doing all these things, it is scary to think about how really powerful the mind is to affect even the greatest of our artists, even the greatest of the people who have been blessed with gifts that can entertain so many and affect so many, how it can get. And so when you said earlier about like, this was maybe your first understanding of that the happiest people can be the most saddest, you're right. I remember that thought as well at the time, going like, wow, this is how insidious this thing can be, right? And then when I experienced, I really viscerally understood what it's like to feel that and feel powerless and feel like you can't even move your arm because you're so concretely stuck where you're at in such an insane journey that your mind takes you on. So I agree with you. It is something that I didn't know until I heard him say it or them describe it that way with him. So yeah, I think you opened a lot, because with Phil was murdered. This is something different, right? And so with that, you kind of understand mental health in a whole new different way. And he may be one of the people who kind of opened the door to mental health for a lot of people who maybe were not aware of it, couldn't put it into a context, or maybe tried to hide from it. Robin Williams' death kind of opened people up to that possibility of what it can do to you if unchecked or untreated, or if other things come in that affect it, and where it can lead to, you know?
I think there's like certain myths that we've tried to explode to some degree on the Cinephiles. And I think one of them is we're all sold this idea that the reason that you're unhappy is because you lack these things.
Right. Right.
Therefore, when you have those things, you will automatically be happy.
Yeah.
So like I would like success, wealth, fame, you know, respect, whatever the things you want to name. Well, Robin Williams had all those things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And as you said, I think your description of he could walk down the street and anyone would buy him a beer or give him a hug is all perfectly true. Yeah. And none of those things are actually what make you happy.
Yeah.
And it's why going to somebody who's experiencing depression and saying, hey, cheer up, you know, you got everything. It's like completely useless, because it's like, literally everyone loves you and wants to give you a hug and you're still sad. You have a nice car. There's money in your bank account. You're successful. You're still sad because, and this is the thing too, is like to a large degree, we are our minds.
Yes.
That's who we are. And that our minds, as much as we want to think that we're in control of them, we are not. Yeah. And it's very, very well documented scientifically that you are not just making decisions and doing what you decide. That is not how our minds work. We do all sorts of things that we say we don't want to do.
Yeah.
We don't follow, and we have all sorts of like this idea of like an intrusive thought. Well, how could you have an intrusive thought? Aren't you in control of your mind? No,
right.
You're not. Thoughts will come into your mind. And like you can, through discipline and practice, learn how to sort of deal with some of those things, but it's not easy. And that particularly, as it sounds like with Robin Williams, which is just so tragic and upsetting, is that he has a disease. You know, it's caused by Parkinson's, and that is literally changing the chemistry, the physical reality of your brain.
Yeah.
And so when you go, I can't control these thoughts that are coming into my mind, it's because you literally can't control the thoughts coming into your mind. As I said, you are your mind, you know? So if you can't, I mean, if there's no hope, I mean, I understand it, you know? And it's just such an incredible tragedy that a person with a brain that could do what his brain could do, and there is no other human, I believe, ever that could do what Robin Williams could do at that level.
Yeah.
And you're no longer in control of your brain and can't do that. I mean, that's terrible.
You know? Yeah, I think that's when you hear people talk about why he did what he did. There's a lot of people that actually, they don't condone it, obviously, but they understand it. They accept it. They see it. And, you know, that Robin felt that it was the time. You know, I'm not going to lie to you. Watching the end of the documentary yesterday, I started crying at the end because right. when they're describing what Ernest was experiencing, I was like, yes, I know everything that they're talking about. I've experienced this viscerally. And it just brought back all those memories. And reading up on the stuff with Robin, I got emotional preparing the document for our conversation today, because just thinking about what he might have been going through, what his brain might have been telling him, and maybe in a moment of lucidity realized, I don't want to spend the rest of my life fighting my own brain, or, you know, this is all too much, or even I need to escape from this because I can think of no other way out than to do this and make this decision. And it's not a coward's way out. It's not someone who gave up. It's someone who his brain told him this, and this is what he did. And I think that's something that people need to explore and give more credit to when it comes to a situation like this, no matter if it's Robin Williams or someone who's not famous. It's how insidious this thing can be, really, in any situation. And one Parkinson's, like Muhammad Ali's Parkinson's, or Michael J. Fox's, is not the same as what Robin was going through. Those are all different things that are involved, different factors, especially with the Lewy's body dementia thing. It all changes you overall, you know. And the thing is, Robin also, like, let's be honest, Robin also had substance abuse issues from yeah. a very young age, certainly with cocaine and John Belushi. Like, he was partying with John Belushi the night he left John Belushi the next morning. John Belushi was dead from the cocaine. So Robin never did cocaine again, but alcohol is something that he struggled with up until the mid 2010s, like 2014. He was admitted to the Hazleton Foundation Addiction Treatment Center in Minnesota to deal with his alcoholism. So that was something that he constantly battled with. And I'm sure that was his way possibly of treating some of those more dark days or sad days or depressing days and what have you. And, you know, a lot of people self-medicate in trying to process that. So it's a shame that he was born with these incredible gifts, but also this overwhelming sadness for whatever reason in his body chemistry that he had to battle with and struggle with through his life until finally taking his life. You know, it's the sad part of his legacy.
Yeah. In no way do I think that you have to be messed up or sad or depressed or have issues or parent stuff in order to be talented or funny or successful as an artist. I don't believe that at all. But I do believe that certain kinds of talent are connected to certain kinds of trauma. You know? Like that. And so I do think, you know, that story of I needed to make my mom laugh.
Yeah.
That's a profound thing. And I don't know, you know, and I also think as we talk about issues of suicide, I should say that the suicide hotline is 988 if anyone yes. and obviously if this is uncomfortable for people to listen to this kind of conversation, I you know, we understand. We literally spent a whole bunch of time discussing this in our latest episodes on Ordinary People.
Yeah.
For me, there's a huge difference between euthanasia and medical suicide for someone who's dealing with incredible physical ailments or prognosis, yeah. I guess, that is very different from suicide in the way we normally talk about it. And so like, you know, from what I have learned is that, and a lot from coming from speaking to you, is suicide is this thing of this moment. And part of the hard thing yeah. is getting past that moment to the next moment, which might be better.
Yeah.
The difference with someone facing a terrible disease is the next moment's not getting better.
Right.
It's not about the moment. It is about the next moment and the one after. And I was just listening just this morning, the Daily, they do their longer stories over the weekend. Mm. And it was about a woman who literally could smell Parkinson's. Wow. And it's a fascinating article. And she discovered it because her husband had Parkinson's. And she noticed 20 years before he had symptoms that he had a new smell. She's like a super smeller. And then later on, and this is very scientifically documented. And it's really interesting. But the thing that she said, and that I've never really heard, is that she said it was the mental changes that were brought on by Parkinson's that were far worse than the physical changes. Right. That everybody talks about, you know, the physical stuff. And that's obviously very difficult if someone can't take care of themselves, feed themselves, walk, all that stuff. That's terrible. Mm. But her husband became hypersexualized, lost his shame, so that he was just kind of walking out in public in his underwear and like doing all sorts of behavior. He was short-tempered. He was all these other things that, and it was the mental stuff that was really hard. And then other people in this article were saying, yeah, that's the thing we're not talking about. And that there are people that actually, they would take them off of medical alerts where they'd say, hey, you have to watch, this person has to be under observation all time. And a nurse would go, oh no, they just have Parkinson's. And they would take him off the observations. And then the person would bash their head against the wall. And so like, the and so that's what, and then of course we're talking about Robin Williams, and I just go like, oh, this is a real thing he was dealing with. And again, he was, from what I've heard about the thoughts that are entering his head, violent thoughts, scary thoughts, self-destructive thoughts, self-hatred thoughts, and he could not escape them. And there is no cure for this. This is where I go into, this is not when we're talking about, you know, a teenager, and I'm not minimizing teenagers who want to kill themselves, but it's a, we have to talk about it in a different way, I guess.
No, I know. And I think it's an ever evolving conversation, but I think we're way farther ahead now than we were 10 years ago when Robin Williams passed away, in the conversation about mental health, in the acceptance of people taking their life, in the struggles that people have. Of course, you've still got the hard-headed, obnoxious assholes on one side who just want to criticize it because they don't get it, they don't understand it, but there's a lot more conversations happening about this kind of stuff that is hopefully, you know, removing the stigma from it as the years go on and people start to understand how devastating and affecting this stuff can be, especially because of how the new chemicals in the food, the new medicines that are being prescribed to people, all this stuff is triggering things in people's minds, body chemistry, you know, all the stuff that's happening in our lives. I hope this is opening the door more and more to these conversations about this kind of stuff, you know, for sure. So we will see. We will see. But, you know, we shouldn't end on that. We should definitely talk about the fact that this was an incredible man who affected so many people. When he passed away, President Barack Obama released a statement that was really moving and touching about him. The United Nations on August 12, 2014, Robin Williams was celebrated during the opening of International Youth Day, when the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and the Assistant Secretary General paid tribute to Williams by standing on the pulpit at the ECOSOC chamber and quoting one of Keating's lines from Dead Poets Society, "Dare to look at things in a different way." People went to, they played Aladdin for a week commercial free on Disney Channel, Disney XD, and Disney, Disney Junior. And then people went to all the different shooting locations of all the great Robin Williams films and left tributes stacked up, especially in the house from Mrs. Doubtfire. There, the Broadway darkened its lights on the evening of August 14th, 2014, in honor of the passing of Robin Williams. That night, the cast of Aladdin, the musical, honored Williams by having the audience join them in a sing-along of A Friend Like Me. So there was a makeshift memorial at the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Boston's Public Garden also experienced, the Pacific Heights in San Francisco home, as I mentioned in Mrs. Doubtfire. The sign for Paris Shoes in Keene, New Hampshire, where Jumanji was filmed, was stacked with tributes. And Boulder, Colorado, the home that we used for Mork and Mindy, was stacked with tributes and flowers and cards of what have you. And if you want to have a good cry, watch Billy Crystal's eulogy to Robin Williams at the Emmy Awards on August 25th of 2014. That was a genuinely moving tribute. And Billy is known for doing those because he did a wonderful one for Muhammad Ali as well. So this is, and you can explore more of Robin Williams. There's a PBS 1 hour special that was devoted to Robin Williams' career. Here's how crazy: Iron Maiden, heavy metal rock group Iron Maiden, dedicated a song to Robin Williams titled Tears of a Clown on their 2015 album Book of Souls that talks about depression and suicide. How crazy is that?
A tunnel painted with a rainbow on Highway 101 north of the Golden Gate Bridge was officially named the Robin Williams Tunnel in 2016. And in 2017, Sharon Meadow in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, the home of the annual Comedy Day, was renamed Robin Williams's Meadow. And if you want to explore more, there is that PBS documentary. There's also the great 2018 HBO documentary on him, Robin Williams, Come Inside My Mind, from director Marina Zanovich, which I think is fantastic. In August of 2020, a documentary was released here for called Robin's Wish, which explored Robin Williams's battle with Lewy body dementia, directed by Tyler Norwood. I was very fortunate to get to interview two of the people involved in that documentary about their experiences with Robin, who grew up with him, who were on comedy stages with him, and were part of the documentary and spoke about what he experienced. They talk about his cycling. They talked about his working out, how that was his way of trying to deal with this stuff as it was starting to come on. It's a fascinating documentary, and they were wonderful to give him that love. And then in 2022, Netflix a Netflix special was released called The Hall, honoring the greats of stand-up, and Robin Williams was inducted into the National Comedy Center there in Jamestown, New York. So, Steve, even to this day, even all these years later, there are still people offering tributes, creating reasons to honor Robin Williams. That's how deep their love and affection for him is. He is in rarefied air in that way as well, Steve, because of the amount of joy he has delivered to numerous generations of people, both young and old, who've experienced him and his work. It's incredible.
I remember when he died, and there was the meme that went around that was the genie, and it said, "Genie, you're free." And I was wrecked.
Good night. Yeah. Good night. I was doing the research. I stumbled upon another cartoon, a drawn cartoon. It's the Pearly Gates and all of Robin Williams's all of Robin Williams's characters show up. And he and Peter, who's ever manning the gate, says, "Wait, but it's just one person." And that just shows you the level of the characters that he created, how they had a life of their own. And in essence, when Robin Williams died, for a lot of people, those characters or their existence died in some small way, although they can still obviously discover them over and over again. But a small part of their existence died with him. So that cartoon has always affected me and stayed with me since when I first saw it to when I discovered it again, getting ready for this show. So, yeah.
Well, this is to go back to where we started. There's nobody like this guy.
Yeah.
And I think the thing too is, again, it's that mix of comedy and drama, but I think more accurately, maybe it's the mix of comedy and vulnerability.
Mm.
Is that there's always, with the exception of when he's playing a serial killer, there's this tenderness in most of his performances. True. And a sweetness that's there. And the other thing, one other thing I just wanted to bring up is he had this ability. One of the great things for those of you who want to go down some YouTube rabbit holes is just watch his appearances on Carson and Leno and Letterman and Conan. And because what's so great about him is that once he starts going, he has like,
oh my God,
comedy aim like nobody else.
Yes.
If he sees weakness in you, and you laugh at a thing, he's like, "Oh, you think that's funny, huh?" Yeah. And then he'll build on it. And you'll see someone like Carson just leaning back because they can't take it anymore, because, you know, you imagine that comedy genius just directed at you. And again, I'll go back just one more time to Comic Relief, which I don't know about you, but that was required annual viewing every year. And part of it was they always had great acts and great performers. And I love Whoopi and I love Billy Crystal. Totally. Mm-hmm. But a huge part of it is, what is Robin going to do? Yeah. What's he going to say? Because you never knew, and they didn't know, and they had to roll with it. And it was among the best real life comedy happening anywhere you could get.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I do want to maybe wrap up here as we get close to the end of our conversation. And I'd be remiss not to mention the influences. Jonathan Winters, obviously a very well-known influence. If you study anything about Rob Williams, him playing his son in Mork and Mindy, I thought was a great way to bring Jonathan in and give him some love and work with him. But also in an interview with Michael Parkinson in 2002 there in England, he said that Peter Sellers was an important influence. And it was specifically his multi-character performance in Dr. Strangelove. And, you know, I cannot believe that I'd never made that connection before, but it makes so much sense
because Robin was so great at creating these incredibly out there characters. I just recently watched Lolita again for the first time recently, and watching Peter Sellers do those different characters as he's doing the things in Lolita, I'm like, this actually makes all the sense in the world when I read this in preparation for the research, that of course this would influence Robin Williams. He is the natural next step of what Peter Sellers did. Great dramatic actor, along with great comedian, in going forward with his life. So it is fascinating to make that connection, and it makes all the sense in the world, for God's sakes.
You know what's interesting, and I haven't researched this, and maybe I'm about to say something that's totally not true, but in thinking back on Robin Williams' comedy,
yeah,
it's rarely about him. You know what I mean? Yeah,
right.
Like, and so the Peter Sellers thing makes a lot of connections, because one of the things that we learned about Peter Sellers, both in Strange Love and I remember when we did Being There, is that there were people that basically he only was these characters. He didn't know who he was as a human. He only could be these other people. Right. Is that Robin Williams expressed himself by becoming other people. Yeah. That's how he did it, you know? Yeah. And I think, but maybe I'm going to take this, and this is, again, maybe this is the comedy versus the acting, because in the comedy, he's playing all these characters.
Right.
Good Will Hunting, that guy seems real. That just seems 100% real, you know?
I think the guy in Good Will Hunting, the guy in Awakenings, is real. Yeah. Like, those are, the guy in Moscow on the Hudson is super fucking real. Like, that's the thing. That's the gift of his work, is that with all the outlandishness and the craziness, especially Adrian Cronauer in Good Will Hunting, Vietnam, at the end of the day, these are actually real people that you would get to know or have known, or you've seen elements of these people in people you have already met in life, you know? And that's what is the joy. Because we talk about comedy, drama, it's the humanity, right? And that's such a cliche thing to say, but I think with capital letters, it fits for Robin Williams. He had a way of capturing humanity in these characters, no matter how outlandish they were. They were believable. You bought into it. You could actually see that you met someone like this or might meet someone like this in the world. And I think that's really the gift of what he imbued into all of his characters, was the humanity. And not a lot of people can do that. And only the greats really can do that with these characters. And I think that's why they endure and why they still affect us so much whenever we watch anything with Robin Williams, the mixture of the joy and tragedy that always comes with it. Now when you watch it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
Well, let's hit some of these Streamlabs and Super Chats before we get on out of here, Steve. Been a fantastic conversation with you, brother. Really been enjoying this one. Wiley OFC says, I remember the day when Williams died. I cried my eyes out. I grew up with him on movies like Night at the Museum. My mom let me stay home and I sat on a couch and just watched movies I have not seen from him. Never forget. Wow. That's an incredible way to offer tribute to him.
And what a great mom to understand that this was an important thing, to let you stay home and just watch movies. So
It's a process of grief. Absolutely.
Yep.
Jonathan Peck. Thank you, Jonathan. That's really kind of you. He says, I remember back in December of 2014, when my mom and my sister picked me up early from school from winter break. They took me to the cinema to see Night at the Museum 3 to see Robin for the last time. And his final line was, smile, my boy. It's sunrise.
Wow. That's a great, great memory. Oof. And a good, again, I love these families that are paying tribute to Robin Williams. I mean, that's lovely. Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's very much appreciated.
Absolutely. And God love your families for understanding that about you all. That's good family that understands you need to process it in a certain way. Spencer, our only Streamlab, said, hey guys, I've been a big fan since your Modern Times episode in 2016.
Wow. It's a deep cut.
It is a deep cut. My question is, what older classic film or genre would you cast Robin in if you had the chance? I'd cast him in a Western, Walter Brennan's part in Rio Bravo alongside John Wayne. Oh my God. Spencer, that's a great, great suggestion. And by the way, Robin Williams, if you see Dead Again, that's essentially a modern noir. He could have fit into noir back then as well. So yeah, Steve, what's your answer to this? What's an older classic film or genre that you could cast Robin Williams in?
So one of the comparisons, and I remember this was the comparison that I think it was my mom or my dad made when I was first watching Robin Williams, is they said, he reminds me of Danny Kaye.
Oh, my God, yes.
So any Danny Kaye, Court Jester, any of those movies, you could plug Robin Williams in and he'd be great. That's my, but I'm thinking more about the sort of the more dramatic side and where would it be interesting to have him? And I'm feeling like, you know what I'd cast him in?
Tell me.
I give him Gene Hackman's role in the Conversation.
Oh, that's a great one. Oh my God. Yes. I think he'd nail that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great choice, Steve. I like that. If we go classic, I would love to see his turn of George Bailey.
I'd love George Bailey, right?
That would be so interesting, especially later in life as an actor and maybe becoming aware of these ideas or maybe becoming more concretely aware of some of these darker days, like to have that play out in a remake of It's a Wonderful Life, or you do it without Jimmy Stewart never being born. You cast Robin Williams as that character. I think it would be fascinating to see what he could do with it. But yeah, the Danny Kaye stuff, dude, that's 100% correct. 100% correct. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, totally. I think what's the
Some Like It Hot, Jack Lemmon character. He'd be fun with that too. Yeah. Go. What you say?
I was picturing him as what's the guy that has the final line of the movie?
Oh, Joey Brown.
Joey Brown. He could do. I was gonna say the actor who's the editor in All the President's Men, Jason Robards.
Yeah.
I think he could play that part in All the President's Men. Taking older Robin Williams, you could plug him into so many of those sort of supporting roles, or Jack Lemmon's role in Glengarry Glen Ross. Robin Williams would be a really interesting person in like some of those kinds of roles.
What about Network? Would you put him as
No, and I'll tell you why. I have a very strong negative reaction to this, and this is the reason. Is that guy, if you're talking about Peter Finch, is that guy goes off.
Yeah. Right?
Is that Robin Williams's drama is small.
Yeah.
It's precise, it's intimate, it's sensitive. Robin Williams' comedy is big.
Right.
Is like I don't think that he delivers that angry speech the way that I would the way that it needs to be delivered. That's my gut. You can of course totally disagree.
I would like to give him the chance. I would have liked to give
sure.
him. Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now. I think that's a Robin Williams role.
He could do it totally.
100%. Yeah. It could be a lot of fun to see him explore that.
I don't think he can do Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. That's not in his range.
Or Brando, no.
No. But he could do a great impression of all those people.
Yeah, yeah. Is there a Nicholson role that you? I mean, would he do One Flew Over?
He would be fascinating in Cuckoo's Nest.
I think Cuckoo's Nest would be the one.
Again, this goes into this weird thing about casting. We were just talking about this. We just did a short that's on Patreon, patreon.com/thecinephiles, about Robert Downey Jr. playing Dr. Doom and whether or not he had scariness in him, whether or not he could be an intimidating villain. And what we were talking about was like that you could be a great actor, but you don't have all the ingredients. I don't know that I've seen Robin Williams be intense or scary in those ways. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I'm not saying he couldn't do it, but I have never seen it. And so I'd be curious to see it.
I'd be curious to see it as well. I think that would be.
Listen, I am not for AI replacing actors, but there are some interesting like takes of going, well, you know, this technology that could make these things happen, sort of.
Well, this may be a preview of a reverse topic we're going to be talking about in a future short on the Cinephiles. So look out for that. Watch out for that. That's
something that
Steve brought to my attention that I'm excited to talk about with him when we get to it. Oh, William H. Macy's role in Fargo, 100%.
Totally.
100%. Oh, my God. I feel like Tarantino would have put him in a film if he'd had a chance, you know. Homicide Life on the Street will be available finally streaming on August 19th on Peacock, and it's going to be HD. So get ready to enjoy that series and definitely go to that Robin Williams episode. Although these episodes are interconnected, the Robin Williams episode very much stands on its own. You guys can watch that and really see the performance, which I think was nominated for an Emmy, or he won an Emmy for that performance as well. So incredible stuff. All right, Steve, let's wrap it up there as we're out of Streamlabs Super Chats. And I think we've certainly given a very strong tribute and remembrance to Robin Williams. What are your final thoughts as we walk away from this conversation, brother?
I mean, my final thoughts are really what my first thoughts were. Mm. There is no one like Robin Williams. There is no human that has ever had that combination of unbelievable improvisational character building, voice building in the moment comedy.
Yeah.
There's nobody else that had that rapid fire ability ever that I've ever heard of. And there's nobody that had that sensitivity, that quietness, that gentleness, that level of intimacy that you felt with his characters. There's nobody that has that combo. And the oddness of that combo is why you get a bunch of movies that don't quite 100% work. And then when they find it in Awakenings and Dead Poets Society and Good Morning Vietnam and, of course, in Good Will Hunting and Aladdin, like when they find that combo, it is just the best. And I think the thing, too, is that because of this oddness of his character is that he is more beloved. I think that's part of why he is so beloved, is because he was so real in his improvisation and you really connected to this is really happening. This is him creating in this moment. And he was so real in some of those performances that you feel a connection with him that isn't like my connection. I feel connected to a lot of celebrities and talented people, but Robin Williams was formative for me. And again, I go back to that moment 10 years ago when I heard he had died and I was wrecked.
Same boat with you, wrecked. Same boat with you in feeling that he's a formative person as I was discovering film and TV as a young teenager. And young kid as well, man. So I absolutely on that road with you. But I think what, for me, the thing that I leave this conversation feeling is that he was unique. And Steve is 100% right. I don't think there's ever been anyone like him, because he touched us in a way that very, very few actors can and very few performers can. Right in our souls, because we sensed and knew and felt in our bones that he was a genuinely good guy. So we genuinely supported him, genuinely cheered for him, genuinely wanted to be entertained by him, and genuinely were looking forward to seeing what he was going to create next. What's he going to do in this movie? Oh, I don't care if it's getting bad reviews. I want to see what he does in it. I want to see what he does and what he creates and where he goes, you know? And I think there's that aspect of him that we all sensed he was a really legitimately good person. And I do want to end with this final story from Sally Field, which she just revealed recently over the last couple of weeks in an interview here. She said, "I never shared this story before. I was in the camper outside of the courtroom where we were shooting the divorce scene in Mrs. Doubtfire. My father had a stroke a couple of years before, and he was in a nursing facility. I got a phone call from the doctor saying my father had passed from a massive stroke." Field said that she tried to push the feelings away, tried to do her job and perform, but she was so numb she couldn't even get herself to cry in the scene as required. Then Robin Williams noticed this, pulled her aside, pulled her away from the set to ask if she was okay. And immediately upon finding out that her father had died, Robin Williams said, "Oh my God, we need to get you out of here right now." And he made it happen, said Sally Field to Vanity Fair. "They shot around me the rest of the day. I could go back to my house, call my brother, make arrangements. And it's a side of Robin that people rarely knew. He was very sensitive and intuitive." And that's what he said. "Robin and I made a deal. He said, we're going to do 2 or 3 scripted takes, and then we're going to go play. And when he did that, I was able to come out of my shell." So these are the kinds of things that you hear about from people who've worked with him. And that's the Robin Williams that I think we all instinctively believe and knew was the real Robin Williams. And that's why his performances still resonate with us today. And we love them as deeply as we did the first time we experienced them. And dare I say, even more so because of his passing as well. So
that's a great story. Great story.
Absolutely. Rest in peace, Robin. Thank you. From behalf of the Cinephiles, thank you so much for all your work and the incredible legacy you've left behind. We can't wait to tackle more of your content on the show when we get to those movies for sure. It'll be a blast for us. And thank you to everybody who joined us today for this conversation and everybody who is going to listen to us in the future here from this conversation. We appreciate you all madly. Steve, what do we have to tell them about being a part of the Cinephiles?
By the way, we had one more question from Chris Retzlaff about a trailer, but I haven't seen this trailer. So I have no opinion on it.
We'll circle back to it, Chris, for sure.
Have you seen this trailer?
Yeah, it's a Saturday Night Live trailer. Yeah, Saturday night. I saw it, a few days ago. Yeah,
I will check it out.
Yeah, definitely check it out. I think it's actually really good. I was afraid it wasn't going to be good. It looks good. So that's
cool.
Yeah.
So the things that I have to tell them, we've already mentioned the Cinephiles. Right now, we just had Ordinary People that went out. We've got, can we announce what our next film is? Because it's awfully exciting.
I think so. Go ahead.
We haven't recorded it yet, and John is going to be leading a discussion into one of the greatest Westerns of all time, which I'm super excited about, which is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, coming this week to the Cinephiles.
Absolutely. And Jeff and I are going to, Steve and I are going to jump off a cliff and into the water in celebration.
I can't swim.
It's going to be a 2-foot cliff, but we're not going to do it.
That's what's coming up. And of course, patreon.com/thecinephiles. If you want to support the show, listen to our Cinephile shorts, join our advisory board. You can also get our shorts and ad-free versions of the show as well on Apple Podcasts, where it's just one click. So if you're an Apple person, that's the simplest way to do it. There are more features and more tiers available at patreon.com/thecinephiles. And of course, cinephiles.net in order to buy or stream every movie we've ever reviewed. And I'm at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
And me, I'm at The Roca Says. And for all of you who listen to us on the podcast version, please remember to patronize all our sponsors who sponsor the show. If you hear a product that you really like, please remember to hit that code and use the code in subscribing or ordering that product so they can keep sponsoring us here on the show. We appreciate all of them. And we have such a wide variety of sponsors who've really enjoyed our show and enjoy our audience. So please thank them by subscribing or ordering their products if they work for you in your life. All right. Thanks to everybody who's joined us. You guys are amazing. And we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode of The Cinephiles or Cinephiles Live in the future. Take care until then.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeMess Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.